It's Saturday, April 9th, 2011, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, geek news, and in the second half, your questions and comments about technology.
The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. In the second half of the show, I'll invite you to join the conversation. You can ask us anything you'd like today. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. Again, the phone number is 1-800-655-5877. I'll give you that information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. Today's theme song is by Dave Patera, who gave us the theme song because he likes to make music. And of course, we like to have music on the show. If you'd like to make a song, if you're a musician, or if you want to tool around a bit, please feel free to make us an MP3, WAV file, whatever, and email it to us. You can find out how to do that by going to geekspeak.org. Click on Contact Us. You'll figure it out from there. And if you'd like to ask us questions during the week, of course, you can go there. And if you'd like to find out more information about anything we talk about today, it's all up on geekspeak.org about a half an hour after we're off air. Because, of course, we are live. Show. And today, live in the air with me, I've got Mr. Miles Elam. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning.
He's a slacker. No, he's not a slacker. He's a programmer and political
junkie. I have not been a slacker lately.
No? You've been working a job hard?
Yes, I have.
Not hardly working, working hard.
Working hard.
You're programming front-end development stuff, JavaScript, things like that?
Java, JavaScript, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Good enough. What libraries are you using on the front-end?
Well, aside from JSP... and then also just straight Java on a Java EE platform. Mm-hmm. Using jQuery, I guess that's the biggest one.
Uh-huh. Are you doing that for UI stuff as well? Using like the jQuery UI, or
yes.
Are you building HTML?
Well, I'm not using. There are elements of jQuery UI in there, so yes, I am using that as well. But there's a lot of stuff that I'm just using as straight jQuery, just being able to make selectors.
And so the HTML is already there, and you're modifying HTML. You're not building everything from jQuery.
Right.
Right. All right.
Right.
Cool. Thank you very much for that. Did you see the funny news story we had last week about CSS, or it happened through the email thread?
Yes. I actually got chastised for not recognizing an April Fool's joke, even though the April Fool's joke was a week late.
Well, he said, I'm sorry it's late.
Yeah, he did say it was late, yeah.
Yeah, but I can't be held responsible because April Fool's jokes when it's not April 1st, I'm sorry.
That article was written well, though, too, because as I started to read it, I'm like, at first off, the parent selector, I've had situations where I wanted that ability in CSS, and then as soon as the database hit thing happened, I was like,
So you should tell everybody what.
Okay, so CSS is called Cascading Style Sheets. It's what actually stylizes the web right now. The HTML documents store data. And you stylize that and make it pretty and colors and all that stuff.
If you're doing it right.
Yeah, if you're doing it right. You do that with CSS documents. And in the CSS document, there's lots of ways to select the HTML and color it and shape it and mold it and do all these different things. Some attributes are just not in CSS. And this article just made fun of new stuff that could be in the next CSS.
They're updating CSS a lot, so it's not that uncommon to have a new update. And you think, oh, wow, I can do that now? And I started reading it. And the thing about CSS is, it's just a text file. And you can just look at it, kind of. If you just, you kind of view source and you can trail it, you can see it. And in the CSS, it had a field for password, name and password. I thought, that's weird. You're putting your name and password in the CSS
the
text file?
Selectors, yeah.
Anybody
can
see that.
That doesn't work. All right, well...
Actually, because I followed CSS development, I saw that and went like, okay, that's immediately not true, and then went, oh yeah, parent selectors. Yeah, that's not going to happen.
Now, why isn't parent selectors going to happen? Are we getting too geeky here?
This is serious geek humor.
Okay, the idea behind a parent selector is you're able to say...
Well, let's say if a link on a page, and inside the link you have an image, and you want to stylize the image, but you also want to potentially stylize the link.
Right.
For putting something else in that same area. Okay.
Right. So you're changing the image, you change the class of the image, and then say that the parent of an image that is of type teaser
right.
Is going to have a certain style. As opposed to the other way, which is very easy, to say that the thing that holds a picture frame, mm-hmm. you know, style teaser, will have an image inside of it that doesn't have a border. That's
so what you're basically saying is in the HTML, you just say this object, this node here is going to be the picture frame, so stylize it. Don't right. look at the picture and then back up. All right. I get the reason why it doesn't work. I just feel like there's been situations before where I'm making like menu items out of lists, and I really
yeah,
want
to be
see.
Very convenient for people. I mean, people have been asking for it for years. It just from a user standpoint, it makes sense. From a computational standpoint, you're ending up.
Oh, it's hell. Oh,
yeah. Right. Instead of having a web browser take nowadays, I mean, web browsers take what? 300 milliseconds to fully render a page or something
assuming
ridiculous
how much,
like that.
Assuming how much outside
yeah, but I mean, like, I'm
happening.
Saying, like, a one with a whole bunch of images sure. and stuff like that. And that's just, like, the rendering, not taking into account getting the files from the server. Just,
right, right.
Just the browser, how to translate really that HTML into something that you can see. If you put in parent selectors, pump that number up by like two orders of magnitude. That's what we're talking about.
Right, right.
Like,
it's just really hard to build a tree. It's not the same type of hierarchical data. It's all of a sudden multiple reverse hierarchical. It's very strange.
Right. It means yeah. every element you'd have to go back. Yeah.
It's a mess. All
and
right.
then you'd end up with these infinite recursion things going on that it'd be a bad scene.
Also with me is Al Luck, a new media architect. Good morning, Al.
Hello, everybody.
You want to geek out about UI design for a few minutes while I just did?
Hey, you know, there is a really cool place that...
well, let's start out with that. Go for it.
Okay. Well, there's... you're familiar with movies that have computers in them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, there's... a lot of times you'll see a movie and there'll be a computer in it. You know, what was it? Minority Report. You know, you notice all these kind of things.
Well, like all the... I mean, all the Star Trek movies, you'll always want to see what's going on the screen. You know, they're using
right.
pads and stuff.
Oh, you mean the ones where they show like a futuristic one as opposed to the current one, which is like, oh, there's a password. Oh, wait, it's got encryption. Encryption broken.
For the most part, yeah, you know, like a big unhappy sign. Or there was the one, what was it, Independence Day, where they sent a virus to the aliens and it was like a skull and crossbones.
Yeah,
and
the Jolly Roger shows up and laughs.
Do we really have to ruin the movie with something like this? Because it's like from the Brady Bunch or something.
Right.
You know, you're
okay,
already...
Okay, so here's the thing. I worked on a full feature film once and I did a UI for it to break mm-hmm. into a security system. And I had this exact problem. This was because what do you do on screen to make hacking look interesting?
Right.
And they're just... It doesn't look interesting, you know?
Well, I don't know, because...
Which you're going to bring up the Matrix, right?
Yes, the second Matrix movie.
inside the Matrix, she's hacking.
Yeah,
and
actual tools.
The thing is, a lot of times, you know, it's just multiple lines of text being drawn
right.
next to it, and you can't read it.
Right.
And it's probably just nonsense, lorem ipsum stuff. But, you know, it'll be like some sort of like DOS screen and green text. But there's a website, and it's not the best name. It's called accessmaincomputerfile.net.
You can get this to geekspeak.org.
Yes. And what it has done is it's gone through all the movies. They've just found all the computer screens in movies that have been out there. And they've done screen grabs.
To show the UI?
A screen grab of a screen. There's a redundancy issue here that I don't want to get into this.
An in-film screen grab.
Yeah, an in-film screen grab. So they've shown all the different ways that people have used computers and how they've predicted that the futuristic computers would look in movies.
Is it just futuristic or is it just all computer UI?
It's all basically they're always every time they show a computer on a movie, they're trying to be futuristic. You know, they never show an old computer.
They never show an actual computer.
Well, they did in Terminator 3.
What did you show in Terminator 3?
They went and found all the computers that were made in the 60s.
To show the bunker.
But,
right.
You know, I went to this site and, you know, being into UI design, to me it was interesting. But then I just kept going and they show the movie that it's involved with. They, you know, you show the thing.
Obscure movies have screens. I mean, this is like a very common thing.
Yeah. You know, there's people out there that specialize in special effects for movies and all they do is UI designs for movies.
You know, what's interesting is that a friend of mine does that. He did, my friend Steve did War Games. He did all the video effects for War Games. He's a kind of bigwig in the film industry. He actually bought my family our first computer, a Commodore VIC-20.
Excellent.
It was doing so well at the time. That was around when those were happening. But I remember I'm looking at his stuff, and yeah, it's a lot of that. And what's happened in the last 10 years is that so many more people are doing this kind of work that the market's been flooded. I don't even know what he's doing now. I think he's
It doesn't look that much better.
No, it never looks better. It's always kind of disappointing.
It's like it seems like a last minute decision. I mean, some things in Minority Report, you know, look kind of cool. But other than that, most computer screens almost look like they're superimposed, like they're wrong. The colors are too bright and it just doesn't look like it makes any sense.
Well, you know, older films, we definitely with CRT screens and film, you definitely had a sync problem when you were trying to get the screen, you know, because the screen's redrawing
right.
And you get the film filming. So normally you had to do something to fix that problem. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the screen would be dark and you just cut in something later.
And by the way, the same thing happens with my girlfriend who's in the medical field. When you'll watch shows that have anything to do with medicine.
Right.
They just constantly get it wrong.
You see people grabbing syringes by like the needle and like, no!
Well, no, I'm not even talking about that. I'm talking about things that a lot of us take for granted. But if you're in the medical field, you know that it's wrong and it just anchors you all the time. Like if someone has a flat line, like their heart isn't beating, you have like, dee, you don't shock it.
What do you do?
I mean, you shock a heart that's in fibrillation that has an irregular beat. You don't shock a flat line.
No way, really. What do you do with a flat line?
I don't know. We'll have to ask Dr. Don that. But I mean, that's the thing. That's the thing you hear over and over again. There's actually a blog. I'll have to look
it
up again.
It's called a defibrillator. It's not a flat line riser.
Right. There was a blog that I saw that was based upon, that was doctors all commenting on House episodes. Of the TV show, the medical TV show House, MD. And it's a fascinating read. Seeing all the different, okay, that wouldn't happen. Okay, that was just wrong. Okay, they did okay with this. Okay, we can accept that.
Sometimes, you know, when I'm, you know, I was just kind of paging through this thing. I think the average person would find this interesting to see all these different examples
screens?
Of computer
I think so.
Screens because they just, the things that people have done over the years, you know, whenever you see somebody look something up or anything, and this page keeps going on and on and on. I thought there was like maybe 10. And
so you can enjoy the pleasure that Al's talking about. Go to geekspeak.org in about a half an hour, and you'll see all these images. There are a lot of them, aren't there?
Yeah,
as soon
as you scroll, there's 10 of them, and then they're reloading, and it's like, whoa.
Al, I'd love to see you do a futuristic UI.
That would be fun. I would I would do that.
Some movie maker. Why don't you hire Al to do that?
All my UIs are futuristic. What are you talking about?
By the way, Al, I love the fact that nice. There's a screenshot of Netscape Navigator 3.0, the splash screen that comes up. That, it's an iconic thing. I love the fact that you made a verb out of lorem ipsum.
Oh yeah.
First off, can you explain what lorem ipsum is?
It's dummy text. It's a section of Greek, I think, that they use. We use Latin. As designers, Latin. Yeah. And you a lot of times when you design things, you don't want to use real text because you start reading it, you can't design it very fast. So you use this dummy text that you can't read. So you kind of say text here. And the first two words of that dummy text is always lorem ipsum. And so I just tended to think that it's called lorem ipsum, and I just call it that. And I think
everyone calls it that, actually.
And now I've created a verb called lorem ipsumed. Just lorem ipsum that.
All right. Miles, I don't have your news stories in front of me, so I can't do a pleasant segue.
That's the thing, though. Yes. I was going to give you a choice.
Okay.
How depressed do you want to be?
Okay.
Or do you want to be happy?
So now, Al, thanks for that wonderful news story about movies and film and futuristic stuff. Miles, you want to bring it down a little bit? Was that good?
That's good.
Bring it down a little bit or bring it down a lot?
Oh, no, go all the way.
Go all the way.
Sure,
okay,
sure.
Let's see here.
Well, you had mentioned that guy bought your family a Commodore.
Yeah, Commodore VIC-20 is what we had. That's how I first learned to program. I was learning programming in BASIC on a Commodore VIC-20.
I'm going to come back to that.
Oh, are you? Okay.
About a Commodore?
Yeah.
Did you guys cover that? I don't know.
No,
it was for you. It was supposed
to be a
hint.
I'll leave it to one of you. Lyle, you can do it.
But, all right.
Here's the depressing story. Scientists have created a worth-saving index for endangered animals.
That's just mean.
Yeah.
Well, yes, but at the same time, it's looking at all the animals, classifying them based upon are they endangered, are they on the critical list, you know, things like that. But at the same time, looking at certain ones where you see, smaller mammals that because of the number of cats and foxes that are around, there's no way that we can really save them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we can throw a huge amount of resources there, and we probably still won't save that species.
You're talking about a strange, like a specific type of mouse or something like that.
Right.
Right. Okay.
Right. So
worth saving and possible to save, you mean? Or worth, like, we really should handle that?
No, worth saving as, or more like classified as not worth saving.
Okay.
As in, no matter what we do, it's probably going to go extinct anyway. So let's spend our money and our resources and our time on animals that we can save.
Mm-hmm.
So how's that for depressing? Just giving up on a species.
We're just giving up.
Yeah.
We're just calling bankruptcy on tons of species.
But that's logical.
The thing is, species go extinct all the time anyway, right?
Yes, but at a much faster rate since humans have taken the fore. So it's taking empiricism and species that whose individuals are well below hundreds.
Wow.
I mean, so, you know, maybe in the dozens.
Mm-hmm.
That they're already having problems. They're in a situation where it's not easy to, you know, uproot a particular environment or...
Right. Okay, so we're giving up on species. Let me ask you, are we...
Or at least species in the wild.
Are we catalyzing their genome, at least? Are we, like, getting a tissue sample so we can resurrect
them
sure
we
if we want to?
Yes, I'm sure we are.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's less depressing. Doesn't that kind of keep you warm at night?
With the fact that people are trying to resurrect mastodons and stuff like that from
old
material.
As long as
we have it frozen, it's not really gone.
It's a basic principle. That's depressing, isn't it?
All right, moving on. So we're not.
I think there are only.
That was pretty depressing, Miles. Do you have a nicer one to warm us up?
I think there are less than 50 JavaScript programmers named Miles that are. That have a veterinarian girlfriend. Actually.
Definitely not.
Well, she's
saving.
Not a veterinarian.
Well,
she's a registered veterinarian.
But you can.
There's very
let
few of them left.
Yeah, it's true. There's not many Miles JavaScript Java developers.
So, I don't know. Just a thought.
Miles, you got a happier story to.
Yes.
Yes.
There is a particular individual who has won tenure in the Department of English and Philosophy at Auburn University.
You know. This is the story that Al was talking about earlier.
Yes.
So last week we mentioned that...
I was actually going to cover the story before the listener called in, so I...
Okay, well, let me cover last week's story real briefly about this. Last week we were talking about Wikipedia and that Wikipedia really... The Wikimedia group that runs Wikipedia really wants to get more experts to be contributing to Wikipedia because the better the expert is, the better the stories get. And there's a lot of esoteric content that... You know, maybe five or six people are really good at that could get on Wikipedia, and then of course the world's knowledge is improved because that's where the data is. You know,
mm-hmm.
So there's just kind of a pull to try to get people. And last week I made a flippant comment to some degree that said that I just made an assumption that it's hard to get somebody that has a lot of work to work on Wikipedia when it's better for them, of course, to publish and get into a peer-reviewed journal because that, of course, will get them tenure. That's kind of their job.
Mm-hmm.
And so, how do you get them to develop on Wikipedia? And I guess you got an answer.
Yes, this individual. I don't know exactly what whether it's Michelle age. He won tenure at Auburn University, Montgomery in Alabama, for doing more than 60,000 edits for Wikipedia, and basically people that were. Mentoring him, we're telling him that he should include it under research as well as service to be able to not just I've done these things for Wikipedia, but also the research of how it's improved Wikipedia as well and what the experience was like for researchers. And
what was his field?
His field, I believe, is in psychology.
Interesting. So to be clear, when you're a university professor, at least in like the UC system, and I'm assuming most universities, you've got kind of three roles. At a research institute, your role of a teacher, your role of a researcher, and your role in service. And service normally in a university environment is, you know, sitting on committees, being administrative, things of that
and
nature.
I'm sorry, the Department of English and Philosophy.
Good. I'm glad you looked that up. So when you're trying to get tenure, when you're working on your academic professional life, you need to fulfill all those roles. You need to teach well. You need to get good, you know, review, do well in teaching. You need to have some interesting research, which normally means publishing. something.
Right, you need to have some research. In other words, you need to expand the scope of human knowledge.
Right, and in the art field where I am, it can be writing, but sometimes it's also being in a prestigious gallery, you know, doing your work so that you bring the level of research in your field up. That's that general idea. And then the last one is service, which normally is about the academic environment, but it's also if you're asked to go speak on your topic at another university and they're going to pay you some stipend that's just going to get you on a plane, you're going to do it, and that's actually kind of part of your community, your service aspect to education, if you will. So go on.
No, I was actually done. Actually.
So, but he got his tenure based on doing this research.
It definitely aided him.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, I thought that's what it did. It did. I mean, I think our listener sent in this even.
Okay.
Arthur Richards, he is a engineer at the Wikimedia Foundation.
Yeah, it was great. He made sure to tell us that,
yes,
so that we wouldn't feel a...
he didn't want to, you know, full disclosure, you know, which
was
really cool.
We've got people who work at Wikipedia listening to our show.
Yeah, only one.
Yeah. That's all we need.
Well, he works at Wikimedia, which is the software branch. I have a friend that works there too, but... Does the video work for Wikimedia? Dale. Sorry, no, I did that wrong. Anyway, we'll go on to something else. But what did we catch everything that he mentioned in this email?
Yeah.
Yeah, good. Mm-hmm. So Arthur, thanks for doing that. Miles, thanks for being up abreast on that as well. I appreciate that. Michael Dale is the person that also works at Wikimedia that I know. But let's move on to the next news story. We got one more before the break. Al, it's you, sir.
Oh, well, this one is interesting because I ran across this. I was going to talk about this car.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been around a while. Some of the news articles I found about it were a little bit older. And it's called the Econetic Fiesta. It's by Ford. It gets 65 miles per gallon. Well,
that's nice.
It's still in the news. And the thing about it is it's an amazing car. It's a turbocharged engine, produces 88 horsepower. It's a great car, but you will never be able to get one.
In the U.S. Assuming you're listening in the U.S.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, because it's diesel, and there's a lot of restrictions on diesel cars, even though this particular diesel is as clean as any other car. The traditionally, diesel's considered a truck, and they like to tax the heck out of it, and it's usually more expensive fuel. They always constantly make it more expensive just to keep the taxes up, you know, because they feel it's what you would have in a truck or a commerce vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just not profitable.
It's strange because diesel is higher, of course, gas per gallon, but it's less refinement, I believe. And it seems a little strange that it's pricier. It's just a tax, mm-hmm. thing.
Well, one of the issues with diesel, at least in the U.S., is we have actually more stringent requirements than Europe does with regard to the sulfur content.
Mm-hmm.
And so... when you have diesel from fossil fuel sources, getting rid of that sulfur and having the equivalent of catalytic converters that can strip that out,
right.
And also reducing the nitrogen oxides that are released because diesel engines usually run hotter, that all plays into it. So it's a harder problem with the restrictions that the U.S. has placed upon diesel engines.
I mean, this engine produces less CO2 than a Toyota Prius. Which is, it's competing for.
Oh, so it's very clean because Priuses are really hot, really good on emissions.
Yes, but they will not have it in the U.S. because Ford just can't make any money selling it here. It's just too difficult, too expensive. But they sell in Europe and in Australia, and people love them. And it's an interesting thing to think about.
That regulation really is keeping this better vehicle out of the States.
Yeah, just keeping...
So that seems like something you need to fix as a political person.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. There's that trade-off. And there's also the amount of gasoline that you can get per unit of oil versus diesel. And biodiesel becomes an issue because that is competing for food sources in many cases.
Do you think we're doing a good job on this kind of regulation and that it makes sense to not have this vehicle in the States?
I think it's a complicated issue.
Right.
My personal opinion is that it's a complicated issue. There's a lot of pros and cons associated with it that it's not easy to just to say, oh, we should X, and you know, suddenly diesels are available or diesels shouldn't be available. I think it's a much more complex problem than something you can discuss, you know, in 5 minutes. And I'd love to have a guest over on that would talk about that. In more
seems
detail.
Like we're always want to do that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so we talked about computers and that a friend of mine bought my family a Commodore VIC-20, which is, I think, the predecessor to the Commodore 64. Mm-hmm. But it might have been there was the same time, different versions of it. It's basically the computer was a keyboard kind of thick. The 64, which everyone knows because it's such a more popular unit, the look of it's kind of that first computer keyboard that people typed. It's all brown keys and a tan body. And you plugged it into your TV, and it had no, it only had RAM. Mm-hmm. So once you rebooted it, the data was gone. And there's even taped cassette decks that you could use to store data on.
That's it did have cartridge slots, though.
It had cartridge slots for games. You couldn't write to them, but you could read to them. And so it had a whole bunch of games right out of the box. And it was definitely a great unit. I loved it, at least. Well, in any case, Commodore 64, 30 years later, is coming out. It's coming out again. This time it's got HDMI ports, USB ports. It's basically a full media computer in a Commodore 64 yeah. case.
So what did 64 stand for with the original Commodore 64?
64 kilobytes?
Kilobytes.
Kilobytes. Okay, good. Yeah. 64 kilobytes of RAM.
Now, what does the new 64 stand for?
You know, I don't know. I've gotten to that. You guys just threw it to me. 64... gigabytes? I don't know. What?
Because it's a 64-bit processor.
Oh, it's a 64-bit processor. Nice. Hmm. Okay, cool. I mean, it looks like it's a 1.8 gigahertz dual-core processor. It comes with Windows. Of course, you could do Linux on it. It runs Linux operating system. You couldn't install Windows on it. And it's, you know, under the $1,000 mark, and it seems like a great quiet machine for your
Well, it's basically a standard computer. Standard
yeah, totally
ATX
computer.
Style motherboard, yep. Standard or mini ATX
you know,
style
it's
motherboard.
It's funny, it has a keyboard. It has a keyboard PS2 keyboard port. Not
oh,
even
really?
Yeah, it's got USB
wow.
as well.
Well, the back of it has that ATX computer. Plate
right,
on
right.
there. So, at the same time, the entire shell is basically a Commodore 64. So, as long as you don't look in the back of it.
Yeah, it looks like a really fun little system. I'm looking for a media computer so that I can be running all the time with low power. This is a little too high a power, but I'm assuming that it might fit the need, and it would be so cool to have one of those for my kids to play on. Love it. All right, you're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Miles Elam and Al Luckow. We're taking calls with questions and comments about technology. The phone number at 1-800-655-5877. You can ask us anything you'd like. GeekSpeak on KSP is supported by Cruise.io Internet, now offering flexible workspace with 10 gigabits of fiber internet in their new building at 877 Cedar Street in downtown Santa Cruz. All the details are online at Cruise.io.com or by calling Cruise.io at 459-6301. Al, do you have a break thing? Yeah, go ahead, please.
There's a cool idea. And this is a game.
This is a geek bit, of course.
Yeah. This is a game, and it's a submarine game, and it is put out by the U.S. Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency.
Hey, they started the internet.
Yes, there you go. They're called DARPA by a lot of people. And what this is, it's a ACTUV tactics simulator, and it's a game you can get. It's free. You know, I assume it's Windows only, but...
Mm-hmm. Probably.
But the way what it is you it's a simulator challenging players to keep track of elusive submarines in ways that have never been thought of before. But the thing about it is that it actually uses this data as users go out there and they call this crowdsourcing. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've done things like this that you know the what is that SETI thing that was a screensaver and
still going on.
SETI at home.
Yeah, there's
search
things like that.
But
this is an actual game that you're playing that's based on a simulator.
And basically you've got a whole bunch of tools you're trying to find mm-hmm. submarines that are in the ocean.
Yes.
And that's the game.
And basically you're anti-submarine warfare. It's an unmanned vessel, but it's a sub-hunting drone. And you're chasing, you know, things, but you're using actual evasion techniques. And the thing about it is that when you come up with these ideas, you have the option to submit your ideas to DARPA.
So as you play the game, you're trying to get better and better at hunting subs underwater.
Yes.
And you have the tools that are equivalent to the current day technology.
Right.
All the data of that can be sent back if you so choose to mm-hmm. do so. And then DARPA uses that library and goes, hey, look, this person's doing success here. Mm-hmm. What strategies are they using? And then they implement better technology or train people with it.
Right. And it's
so you two can train sub hunters.
It's the first time I've ever seen. I mean, I've seen some
stuff
kind of
like
stuff
this
in movies.
A lot. Yeah, no, but, this kind of thing. We were talking about this a few years ago about flying as well. but something similar to this.
Yeah, we'll have a link to on geekspeak.org where you can get this app and try it out. And
thank you. The Resource Center for Nonviolence presents a special screening of Meryl at the Del Mar Theater in downtown Santa Cruz this Sunday morning at 11 a.m. The film depicts a young East Jerusalem girl dealing with the effects of war in every corner of her life. Proceeds benefit the Resource Center's Mideast program. Information at rcnv.org. Again, that's rcnv.org, Resource Center for Nonviolence. GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Home and Small Business Tech, providing IT support to businesses and tech support for home computers. Home and Business Tech specialize in protecting data and have been providing data storage, recovery, virtualization, and maintenance for over 10 years. HASBtech.com. HASBtech.com. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, Al Luckow. He's a new media architect. And Miles Elam is a programmer and political junkie. We're taking calls with questions and comments about technology. You can ask us anything you'd like. 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. We might have calls already in, you guys. It's so exciting. But I'm not sure. So we'll go on with the news story. Miles, it's your turn, sir.
Okay, this is some big news. A star.
Ooh,
big.
That's big, really big.
Ball of incandescent gas.
Please correct yourself.
Yes. Miasmic plasma.
Miasmic plasma. Thank you very much. Go on. Anyone to call in with a reference on that, please feel free to do so.
And it's held together by its own gravity. I mean, you have the force of the fusion reactions are always pushing outward, but the mass of that star keeps it so that it's together in a big, relatively spherical ball.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens when something that's a greater source of gravity comes nearby?
Like a neutron star?
Like a black hole.
Oh.
Like when the star gets a little too close.
I think it's like this.
It's more like a...
Wait, why does it blow?
Because...
The black hole swings by this large sun, and the sun's mass slowly starts getting sucked
away.
Star gets sucked into the black hole, and it slowly loses mass until.
Well, the thing is, though, that a star, excuse my my voice cracks, getting over a cold here. A star is many, possibly millions of kilometers wide, mm-hmm. which means that in diameter, which means that the near point of the star to the black hole has a much higher point of gravity,
sure.
a much higher attraction to the black hole than the far side, which means that it's not just, oh, stuff's getting trickling. The entire star is getting spaghettified.
Yes.
Getting scrunched, you know, and just torn apart. And so normally when stars get torn apart because they're reaching the end of their life and you have a supernova, you have a big explosion. Well, this one, you have a big explosion as well, only it's because the black hole is ripping all the material out from the star and mm-hmm. just completely tearing it apart. So why do I bring all this up?
Yeah.
Because astronomers have actually witnessed this.
Oh, neat.
They saw a star actually getting torn apart, or rather they saw a star 4 billion years ago getting ripped apart.
But did they watch the event of it blowing or being ripped apart? Was it a quick event?
Yes, it was relatively fast, and get this. The light that was emitted from this, the explosion, was the equivalent of the light of a trillion suns.
Wow.
Whoa. So it's like a supernova happening.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
it's a supernova happening.
Or more so.
Wow.
A trillion suns is a lot.
That is a lot.
So basically it's a big star that just completely just...
Got ripped apart.
It kind of just destroyed. It just sort of got destroyed.
We didn't do the sound effect correctly the first time for that.
All of that material that the sun was made of gets pulled into the black hole, but it's not getting pulled just into the black hole and disappears. You're having it also do like kind of like an orbit, and it's getting whipped around. Imagine, for example, the way we send probes out. We send it out, and it goes around the Earth to get some slingshot to go faster,
sure.
or we send it off to Venus to slingshot mm-hmm. around and make it faster. Imagine this on a supermassive black hole scale.
Right.
So the speed that you can get, especially, for example, we do things with satellites where we have to make sure that the satellite doesn't get destroyed by our actions. Black hole doesn't care. So it's just whipping that material around and just it's going at super fast, super heated speeds. The things are, you know,
and then of course, as soon as you don't have that extra mass pushing against the fusion reaction, it's all of a sudden exposed and just goes.
Right.
Very cool. We didn't do the sound effect correctly the first time on that, so let's do that again.
That's the correct
sound. That's really good. Yeah, okay, I like that.
Because it's in space.
Yeah. We're going to go ahead and take a call from Doug. And Doug is in Santa Cruz. And welcome, Doug, to GeekSpeak.
Hello?
Hello, Doug. Welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello. How are you?
Quite well, thank you. How are you doing?
All right.
Oh, good.
Sun is up.
Yeah, it's sunny today. So what's up? What's your question today?
I was wondering about something that's been coming up on my Internet Explorer.
Okay.
It says Internet Explorer has modified this page to prevent cross-site scripting.
Okay. We can clarify that. Shall we, Miles?
Well, which version of Internet Explorer are you using?
I have number 7.
IE7?
Really? It modified the... I've never seen that message before from IE7.
Well, what's cross-site scripting, Miles?
The idea behind a cross-site scripting attack is that...
it's not necessarily an attack. First off, it could just be...
Right. Cross-site scripting is merely... You have a web page. Let's say it's geekspeak.org. And geekspeak.org is executing a script that it loads from google.com. And that's a very common thing for people to do if they're doing some search utilities.
In fact, on geekspeak.org, there is a script being executed by google.com.
Google Analytics,
usually. That's right.
Google Analytics. And the chat thing that you would put on there.
The chat on every page, that's true as well.
Mm-hmm. And people commonly do that with calendaring and stuff like that. So that's a great example of showing that. But Google is an example of what we would consider, oh, it's beneficial. We're choosing to have that happen. It is possible, on the other hand, to... set up scripting, especially on sites like MySpace, was definitely due to this because people could put their own markup and their own styling on there, where you can point to a malicious site that loads in a script file, and then anyone who goes in with their web browser, suddenly that script has access to do other things and get access to your...
Here's an example. Like right now, the content that's on Facebook, it has your login information. Facebook has access to your login information. That's why whenever you visit there, it's already always logged in. And potentially from geekspeak.org, we could try to write a script that would attempt to get the Facebook information by opening a page of Facebook in your browser in the background, adding scripting code to it, and get access to that content. That kind of thing is very... prohibited, and when you attempt that kind of thing, you might see an error like this. And so the question is really what site you're going to. Doug, where is it that you see this error? Is it kind of all over the place, or is it specifically to a certain web page?
Well, commonly it's coming up on my Yahoo web pages when I go from one site to another, where I guess they're doing, like you say, where they're sharing information.
Yeah.
Do you have...
And so when they share the information, they're modifying the page so that it doesn't, nothing can slip in.
Do you have any type of antivirus software or web securing software installed? I'm wondering if this isn't Internet Explorer 7 itself, but rather some software that's installed as like a toolbar or something like that.
I use Avast.
Avast?
Yes.
So that I could see something like that.
Antivirus system, and I also have Big Fix. And then within Internet Explorer, they have a regular check.
Yeah, I think what's going on is the security settings you have is giving you a warning of something that's probably just poorly written code. No one's probably doing anything bad. And IE7's choices that you can make on security levels, if you will, are set such that it blocks something that Yahoo is not expecting to have a problem with. Like, most likely nothing vicious is happening. Definitely what's happening is your machine's being more careful than Yahoo's pages want you to be, right? That makes sense.
Okay.
I think you're basically in a space where if you can ignore it. If you're getting frustrated, change the security settings so that you don't get the warning anymore, or update your browser.
Yeah. Do you have a particular reason why you're using Internet Explorer 7?
Yeah, when I tried 8 and 9, I found them to be more clumsy than the 7, and 7 was more streamlined for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I could just, like, you know, move around a lot quicker.
Have you tried Chrome or Firefox or Opera?
I have tried Mozilla. I've tried Firefox. I've tried No, I don't know about Chrome.
Uh-huh. And why didn't you use Firefox? Did it feel too big and bloated?
I don't know. I'm more of like a visual person that likes a cartoon world rather than somebody who likes a virtual kind of like anime world, like, you know, darker, you know, like I don't really fit into that type of visual.
Mm.
I can dig it. But
yeah.
I'd rather
if you do try Firefox has the ability to reskin it to look just like an Explorer. You can choose a theme.
Oh, really? Also,
yeah. If it's just the visuals that's stopping you, the only reason is that most likely you want to get to the most current browser you can, i.e. 8 or 9, actually, at this point.
Well, 9 is only available if you have Windows 7.
I should jump up and then try Mozilla or try Crow or something, huh?
This is me coming in as a web developer. I'm not a big fan of IE7.
Uh-huh.
So,
and why is that? What's the skinny?
Well, as a web developer, it's harder for me to support that than other browsers. It actually ends up, I end up having to take a lot more time to make Internet Explorer 7 and Internet Explorer 6 look the way I want it to than with other browsers. Are also issues with
security. About activity, are you able to move about?
We don't use it. Internet Explorer.
Well, I do use it, but I do it for testing. Yeah.
I mean, the thing is, you don't want to be an older browser. You really want to get a more current day browser. And most likely, the error messages you're going to get are going to disappear just when you upgrade a browser. And I highly recommend that you're on 8, unless you go to Windows 7, and then you go ahead and go to IE9. Those are different things.
It's if you're staying with Internet Explorer.
Or Firefox 4, or Chrome, the most recent version of Chrome. That's going to be our recommendation. And I don't think you have to worry about the error. If you can ignore it, then go for ignoring it. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Well, one quick question, Miles. Do you have any opinion about UIs for GNOME 3?
I don't understand what you mean by UIs for GNOME 3. Do you mean like skins?
What do you guys think about the UI for GNOME 3 from our chat?
Oh, well...
not much opinion?
I don't think it's as good as OS X. And with regard to GNOME 3 versus... for example, Ubuntu's Unity, they've been moving to instead of...
Yeah, they're moving to Unity instead of GNOME.
Or GNOME 3 is that particular style. They're still using GNOME software in the back end. I don't have a strong opinion about them. Just don't...
I have a comment about this Internet Explorer
Please.
Thing. A lot of times, you were saying how you have to use Internet Explorer because you have to test on a lot of people, you know...
For the most part, it isn't individual users. It's actually companies.
Okay.
Because they have internal software that is...
Yeah, it runs on that. Well, there's an actual thing that a lot of people think, Internet Explorer is a PC-only thing. If you're on a Mac, you think, well, I have to install Parallels or VMware or something. But actually, Safari has the ability to pose as Internet Explorer. And a lot of people don't realize this. You can just go into your preferences and go to the Advanced tab. And then you can actually pick which browser you want Safari to pose as when you're loading a page.
That's a user agent, so
you'll get the same content from the server that Internet Explorer would be getting, but you won't be able to do the same things with it because Internet Explorer has capabilities that are different than other browsers. And lots of times, the reason why the work environment uses Internet Explorer actually has because of those.
There's some specific things in there.
Well,
yeah,
there are things like ActiveX controls, which are completely out.
You can't use
Safari.
ActiveX.
But you're right that lots of times the detection stuff that says you can't use this, you have the wrong browser.
Sometimes you can get in anyway. You just got to do this little thing, and then you can get in. And because, you know, overall, if a company is just making that kind of commitment, it's...
Well, the thing is,
it's kind of closed-minded.
The companies that are doing it are not doing it because they can't get to the sites that they need. What they're doing it for is because 10 years ago, they had some software written for it, and it was written for Internet Explorer 6 because that was the best browser at the time. And that used certain idioms from JavaScript. It maybe even took advantage of some bugs that were in Internet Explorer 6. Right. It used practices for layout that just aren't used anymore.
So now when you look at it with the new browser, it doesn't work?
So now if you look at it with the new browser, it may work or it may not. Different things change. Some things might be out of sync. A box that was aligned correctly may suddenly be covering up a checkbox that you had before. some process may go wrong, and it costs more for them to retest with a new browser and recertify all those applications, many of which they may not have the source code to anymore because all of those consultants that wrote it mm-hmm. have since gone on to do other things.
They're all millionaires and had their own
startups. Or the company went out of business, or who yeah. knows. So there is a business case for it that goes beyond just a user agent string. It actually is the rendering engine that mm-hmm. is important.
Let's go ahead and take another call from Salinas Wren. Welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hey, good morning. I have to tell you, you guys really are deep.
We are.
Wow. I listen to you, and my mind is racing to keep up with you. So I have a really dumb question. I have a daughter that's going to college, and I know I want to get her a laptop. Mm-hmm. But what help me?
Okay, good, good. What first off, what I would do is find out what college she's going to, and also, does she have an idea of what her major is?
She's probably going to become a teacher, but major in sports medicine.
Okay. So the reason I ask that is that the university-specific some areas are focused on certain computers versus others. I think you're not going to do – you probably won't do poorly at all to get a low-end MacBook. Right? It's probably what most students get when they go to college. Geeks, okay. Got any recommendations on
that's
this?
That's probably, one? I mean, that, I was thinking the same thing. Like if she was going into, for example, like architecture or something, you may need some CAD program.
That's right.
You know, so, but it doesn't sound like that's what she's doing. So really, you can get anything you want. And I would suggest getting something easy for her. If she's not like a geeky person, don't get her some complicated machine that's, you know, a low-end MacBook is actually a great choice. But you could probably get a PC as well.
Are you a PC or Mac home?
PC.
Okay. And is she a geeky person? Does she code at all?
No, she's not.
Okay. I'm at a university, right? And I'm, of course, they're on the arts division of the university, but almost everybody's got MacBooks, the incoming students. Yeah. There are some Windows users, normally in the sciences, but that separation is not that drastic. Though, you know, I'm in a liberal arts school, and I don't know where she's going, but it could be different.
Yeah, that's
liberal arts, and there's a fair amount of sciences at UCSC, and there are a lot of science folks there who have Macs. So
yeah. Here's the thing: like now, the professors that are from computer science that come over and hang out with me and such, they've got Mac laptops. They're using Macs.
Let's put it this way: every geek that's in the air room right now has a Mac in some form or another. Allison there with an iPad too, but that's.
And you know that I go to meetings now, and I meet with very large Silicon Valley corporations. Technology corporations, and I go to a meeting with 10 people in the meeting at the table, and every single one of them has a MacBook. There might be like one engineer. Like I remember one of the last meetings I went to it was like 10 people in the meeting, and like one person had a PC that was just he was an engineer, and just that sometimes engineers like them, you know. So I don't know, maybe if it's whoever I'm meeting with, but they're technology people, and they're all using them, so they just use what's quick and easy. And nowadays, platform independence, you know, I mean.
Wren, thanks for the call.
Oh, do you have, listen, I love you guys. You're great. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Bye. I think we got time for one more call today from Santa Cruz. Again, all the calls from Santa Cruz. That was when was from Salinas. Okay, from Santa Cruz. Boyd, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello. I am from Salinas.
You know what? I'm going to need you to speak up a lot. Can you get louder on your phone for somehow?
Yeah, I'm on a...
There you go.
There we go.
Great.
Sorry, I'm from Salinas. I'm in Santa Cruz at the moment.
Okay, that's good.
Okay, so I want to a quick question on your prior string of thought. I tried upgrading to Internet Explorer 9, and I use Yahoo Mail. Uh-huh. And every time I try to update to the newer Yahoo interface, it goes into this locking cycle. I click on the inbox, and it starts flashing between inbox, main screen, inbox, main screen, inbox, main screen. Mm-hmm. You have to hit escape in the middle to get it to quit.
And that's
it's happened on both.
And that's using Internet Explorer 9. For Yahoo's most recent mail features.
So both my PCs, laptop and desktop, have Internet Explorer 9.
And therefore and Windows 7.
Correct.
Okay.
And I tried to update to the newest Yahoo, and it's just completely useless. Mm. It literally, both machines replicate it. And
see, it sounds like to me
flashes.
That too many developers at Yahoo are using Macs. That's the problem.
Well, there's also, I mean, I use Windows at my office, mm-hmm. but I'm on an XP machine. Like, there's still that push to go to Windows 7. I actually need to do that update so I can start testing.
So you can experience this. Yeah, of course.
So I can start testing in IE9.
So you're saying the stuff that you're developing might not work in IE9. You don't know necessarily.
I actually know some of the visual artifacts that will come from using IE9 already, mm-hmm. Specifically my use of gradients. But overall, I've tried coding things so that they're browser agnostic. But what you're describing sounds like...
I'm seeing all sorts of people on the web right now saying the same thing. I got an Explorer 9, and now Yahoo Mail won't load. I'm in the forums right now.
It's a Yahoo... The good news is a Yahoo bug.
The good news is they'll probably fix it soon.
Yeah, because like they're saying, oh, load this version of Internet Explorer. It's optimized on Yahoo. I'm like, I don't want your optimized version. I want the standard Internet Explorer.
Right.
And I haven't tried other things yet, but...
Unfortunately, we don't have a solution for you, I don't think.
Yeah, you either use the older interface for Yahoo, you download Chrome and use that for a while, and then go back to using IE9 in a month to see if it gets fixed.
I think I would, in your shoes, I would probably recommend Chrome just for mail. I mean, if you keep your links, it's still not going to launch it correctly.
Well, the bottom line is that until Yahoo fixes that problem...
There's no way to fix yourself.
Yeah, it's not your problem.
Or rather, it is
your problem, but there's nothing you can do about it. That's right.
Let's switch to a Google problem.
Okay.
But almost certainly Google Chrome will work with Yahoo Mail.
Yeah.
Like, I have used it myself.
Boyd, you've got another question? Go for it.
Yeah, just trying to go real quick. For vacations, I usually load up a string of photos on Google Picasa and then send a link out to my friends, and they can see my pictures because I don't want everything on Facebook and broadcast to the world. And now they've updated it so much that now that functionality has become so cryptic that I can't use it. And I'm an engineer.
Right. Meaning sharing your photo collection with somebody else is just not possible.
So it's there somehow, but I spent an hour trying to get to work last night, and I just wanted to slam my computer. So I thought, call the guys and see what you guys recommend
What I use for photo sharing is a site called SmugMug. I'm kind of in love with it, but it also works really well with my Lightroom storage management system. But I really like SmugMug. I got to say that that's a pretty good photo sharing space. You can make different albums. You can one password, let anybody see them. It's pretty nice. I personally like that one. Anybody geeks out of anything else? We're kind of running out of time.
I think that's a good choice.
All right. We're going to go on to that. Leaving that is the answer. Thanks for the calling.
Thank you.
This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at kosp.org. My name is Lyle Troxell. Al, quick, crazy USB of the week.
Well, this is pretty crazy, and I was double-checked it because this thing was on Forbes.com. I thought, could this be April Fool's? But it came out April 7th. It's the $100 USB. It's basically, they're calling it a porn stick. And what it is it's a it's by Paraben Corporation. And it's a little USB, memory stick that you put in a computer, and it searches the entire PC for porn. And it has algorithms in there that look for flesh tones and things and file names and all that kind of stuff. It's mostly a business thing that, you know, you kind of put it in there to clear out a machine if you try to, otherwise it has to be done manually. It could be a liability for the company. But very weird, interesting thing, you know.
Yeah, I wouldn't even say it's that crazy. I see the use for it.
Yeah, there is a use.
For home use, I would assume it's pretty convenient for parents that want to check their 15-year-old's computer.
Exactly, yeah.
And does it just show you it? Does it erase it off out of the
It actually
of hand?
Removes it. It's got all these things you can do with it. It's $100, so it's kind of, you know.
Kind of pricey.
Pricey.
Sounds a little error prone to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does to me too. I'm thinking, I've got pictures that are flesh tony that aren't porn.
It does have an interface and it's got a little.
And all your baby pictures are gone. Oh, no.
Supposedly it's very fast.
And your pictures of tractors. That was something that's come up before.
Pictures of tractors?
Yeah, because they just happen to have the right color scheme.
It can search 70,000 images in an hour, which is just bizarre.
Wow, that's a lot of pictures.
Yes.
Coming up next is Car Talk. Car Talk on KSP is made possible by a grant from the Holly Family Fund at the Community Foundation of Santa Cruz County. We appreciate their support. My name is Lyle Troxell. The Geeks Today are Miles and Al, and we'll be back next week. Geek Speak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used with permission. See you next week. Thanks for listening.